Okay, everyone, we'll start, and the people who come late will join us. This will be our last class on Revishers on the Meltzer. We will, I want to complete with him today, although we won't start till next class, I'm pretty sure. The next figure, here he is, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Charlap. But we're going to spend today one more day on Revishers Zalman Meltzer. And I just want to, we finished really his story and his major, the major events in his life, with the exception of one event, and I just want to bring together some loose ends. But before I do that, I want to return to something I discussed last class. I've discussed it a number of times, and I don't think I necessarily said it correctly. And that's the Agudas Yisrael's attitude towards the creation of a state of Israel. The fact is that it's an ambiguous document, and there's been different interpretations of it. And I had correspondence after last class with Mitchell Morgenstern, who I see is with us, and I've actually described it in different ways. Last class, I said that the Aguda, said that they accept a state, Al Tanai, on the condition that it'll accept Torah ideas, meaning the implication of that is that if it wasn't going to be a religious state, then they wouldn't accept it. And Mitchell challenged that, and really he is correct. And I haven't always cha haven't always I think I maybe even misspoke, because I haven't always described it in that way, although that is how many have understood it. What I want to do is I want to read you actually what the statement said. You'll see the ambiguity in it. And I'll take back what I said last time, and or at least when I used the word al tanai, on condition. I think the way I explained it, other than that, is correct. And this was the most important statement of the Aguda, the most important position in the 20th century. And it's what enabled the Aguda to join the Israeli government, although some said that it was a betrayal of this statement to join the government. So let me just read it to you. Spend a couple minutes on this. It's come. You can see the document in Hapardes, year 11, number 6, page 8. I don't know what month it is, because I only printed out the page, but you can easily find it. And the title of it is the decision of the Moatzet Gedolei Torah regarding, division of the land, Chalukat Ha'aretz. As I mentioned, there was debate over this issue between Rav Chanan Wasserman or Rav Aaron Cutler on the one side, opposing the state and opposing any acceptance of Jewish homeland ruled by Jews in the current era. They weren't arguing from the three Shavuot or the Satmar Rav or anything like that. It was just that it was obvious that any rule of a state at that period of time, we're talking about 1937 now, that's when this convention was, would have been dominated by the non-religious. So it says as follows, the statement. Our holy land was given to us from the master of the universe with a Shavua and a Brit Olam, an eternal covenant, so that we live there in accordance with the way of Torah and to fulfill the Torah's mitzvot. The land of Israel is attached to this land with all its soul and spirit for eternity. Because of our sins, we were exiled. I don't know why the light keeps going on and off. Sorry about that. Because of our sins, we were exiled from the land, and God promised us through his holy prophets that he would redeem us with the Messiah, and that is one of the principles of our faith that every Jew is obligated to believe in. Paragraph one. There's five paragraphs. It's the zechut of Am Yisrael on the land, the Holy Land. This zechut is the foundation of it is in our Holy Torah and in the prophecies of the prophets, the promises of the prophets. Kiyum Medina Yehudit, the existence of a Jewish state, is only possible if Chukat HaTorah, if the law of the Torah, is recognized in it. And that the Torah will be the fundamental chukah, the fundamental law, constitution, whatever you want to say, of the land, and that there will be a Shilton HaTorah, that is a Torah rule, in Hanhagat HaMedida, in running the state. So it says that the state of Israel is only possible if it'll be run in accordance with Torah rules. Medina Shel Yehudim, a Jewish state, which is not miyusedet, which is not based on Chukei V'Shilton Torah, on the laws and the rulership of the Torah, is a denial of the origin and of the eternity of Israel, and denies the essence of the nation of Israel, and undermines the existence of our people, and it ceases to be a Jewish state. Okay, so you could read that as saying that they don't want a Jewish state. Again, the tech support, maybe you can help explain why. I don't know why my face keeps going out. It keeps getting dark. What it has said is that a state that doesn't follow Jewish law is opposed to everything that Judaism's about, and it ceases to be regarded as a Jewish state. They haven't yet said, though, that if it's a choice between that or nothing, they prefer nothing. Then it goes on. The next two paragraphs are short. Next three. The Holy Land, which God set up its borders in the Torah, was given to the nation of Israel for eternity. Any compromise on the Holy Land, mamash, is of no is of no significance. As we know, at this time, they began talking about division of the land. The fourth paragraph, the Moatzat Gedolei HaTorah, the Torah, Council of Torah Sages, recognize that all discussions regarding the future of the Holy Land without the involvement of the Orthodox community does not have any legal validity. And the last paragraph, the Moatzat Gedolei HaTorah turns to all Jews with a strong call to help at this important time, help Agudas Yisrael in building up the land of Israel. Already we see a difference between the Hungarians, who wanted nothing to do with building up the land of Israel, and there were some members of the Aguda who also didn't want anything to do with that, but the Moatzat Gedolei HaTorah calls for building up the land of Israel, Avodat Binyan Artzeinu in building up the Holy Land in accordance with Torah values to strengthen the Orthodox population there and put the chotem of Shmirat HaTorah and the holiness of the land on all everything in the land of Israel. So this statement can be understood to mean that the Aguda only wants a state to be recognized if they follow Jewish law, and then it's an all or nothing proposition. If it doesn't recognize Jewish law, if it's a state as was established, then they don't want it and they prefer not to have a state. But and that's how some have interpreted it. But the majority, and Mitchell's correct, the majority never saw, not just in 1948, but even in 1937, the majority never saw this as an all or nothing proposition. What they were doing was putting forth what they believe is their values. And yes, a state which doesn't follow Jewish law, they would agree with that, is a denial of everything that the Torah stands for, and it ceases to be regarded as a Jewish state. However, that doesn't mean that they said that if it's that or nothing, that we'll take nothing and be ruled by the British or the Arabs. On the contrary, the majority assume that no. You can't call this a Jewish state because it's not following Jewish law, but yet it still is a state of the Jews. And it's our responsibility, they assumed, to try to make it a Jewish state and rather take this than anything else. And you know, this is pretty theoretical. When they spoke about it after the Holocaust, there really wasn't any doubt at all. So I believe that's the correct interpretation. It certainly is what the majority of the Aguda accepted as the interpretation, not seeing it as conditional, although some did view it as such. Okay. Let's now return. A couple of final things I want to speak about. In the classes on Rabbi Ochanan and Wasserman, and those who've heard these classes, I'm not going to go through it in detail again, just to remind you of this. But we saw Rabbi Ochanan and Wasserman's position that you know, should the Orthodox Jews in the land of Israel be a member of what's known as the Vahd HaLe'umi? The Vahd HaLe'umi was the Zionist organization, the Jewish agency that controlled the Jewish communities. That was the representative. Or you could be not be a part of that and be a part of the small Eda Haredit, the separatist community, and pretty much no one joined that. Even the Agudists who came to Israel, they all remained members of the Vat HaLumi. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, as we saw, was opposed to that. He thought you couldn't have anything to do with that. We saw how the Chazon Ish rejected his position, and we saw, and I mentioned, and I'll just repeat now again, and I'm sorry why my face keeps going out. There's obviously a technical problem. I assume, though, you're hearing me properly. Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer also opposed Rabbi Chanan's position and had no problem with Orthodox Jews being a member of the Vat HaLumi, a member of the larger cooperative, even though it was run by non-religious Jews. And the problem of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, that is the problem he had, was that, as the Chazon Ish pointed out, every community in Poland and Lithuania was identical to what you had in the land of Israel. That is, you had in Vilna, in Warsaw, in every single community without exception, you had one town government, that is Jewish town government, in which you had the non-religious, the socialists, the Bundists, all the people, all voting, and you had a town commission, that is a Jewish town commission, and this town commission would elect the rabbi, and sitting on the town commission, you had irreligious Jews and non-religious Jews. In Brisk, you had that. So, for example, in Vilna, the people who decided who the rabbis were, who the dayanim were, these were religious and non-religious Jews, and that was never viewed as a problem. It was always viewed as a problem in Germany and in Hungary, but in Lithuania and Poland, it was never an issue. And therefore, Rabbi Chanan's, I mean, the Chazon Ish's point was, and Rabbi Zalman Meltzer's point was that what's the problem? This is how we existed when we were in Poland and Lithuania. And they made the further point that the local rabbi has, there's no involvement, there's no interference. So, you're in this committee, so Ben Gurion is representative, and you have Orthodox representatives, but on the local level, the rabbis just function the way they function, and there's no interference. It's even a better situation than it was in Poland and in Lithuania. So Rav Isser Zalman writes to Rabbi Elchanan, as we spoke about, and he doesn't understand why he was so so opposed to this. On the contrary, Rav Isser Zalman says that by being a member of the Vat HaLumi, that allows you to be appointed to rabbinic positions, it allows you to improve the kosher situation, the mikvahs, everything for the community at large. It's the exact parallel to the situation today. Any rabbi who wants to influence a community today has to be involved in the Lord, has to be involved. And that means that you're a part of the, you're not a separatist. You're part of the Jewish community as a whole. What exists today with the system of Dayanim and Batei Din and everything, that's just a continuation of the Vat HaLumi system, and that's a continuation of what existed in Poland and Lithuania. Religious separatism of the German-Hungarian sort never took off in the land of Israel. And as we saw, Rabbi Chanan didn't buy it. And he was always more to the right and more extreme than the other rabbani. Now, this made perfect sense for Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. As we saw, when he comes to the land of Israel, he becomes Rosh Yeshiva at Eitz Chaim. The Eitz Chaim Yeshiva was in the orbit of Rav Kook. It was a member of the old Yeshuv, but it was the moderate side, and it was in the orbit of Rav Kook. And Rav Isser Zalman develops a very close relationship with Rav Kook, a relationship they already had in Volozhin. Now, this relationship, as I mentioned, is documented in this book, Az Nidbaru, Yirei Hashem. And Rav Kook was older than Rav Isser Zalman, so Rav Isser Zalman looked up to him. But Rav Kook also looked up to Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. When Rav Isser Zalman comes to the land of Israel in the 19, was it, we said 24, Rav Kook is waiting for him at the Jerusalem train station. Not only did they continue to have a close relationship, when the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva actually put out, literature discussing the yeshiva, Rav Kook sent them a letter of rebuke. This is printed on page 19 in this booklet, because he thought that they didn't give enough stress and emphasis on Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. He writes to the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, Rav Kook, that I think that I have a chovah gedolah to express my great distress and my protest that the booklet that you published in Yiddish which told about the history of the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, in that you didn't stress Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer enough, the glory that he brings to the yeshiva. Now, this doesn't mean that they saw eye to eye on everything. In fact, Rav Kook himself acknowledges this wasn't always the case. On page 20 of this booklet, they have a letter here from Rav Kook to his son-in-law. His son-in-law was Rav Natan Ra'anan. He says in this letter, he mentions that the friendship I have with Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, you know, it's a great friendship, but sometimes, lifamim, there are chilukei deot, there are disagreements between us. But he says it's through friendship, and in the end, we're wonderful friends. He acknowledges sometimes, he says that etzem hadibor, that when you have discussions, it could hafriya ktsat, it could create some disturbance. I guess he's alluding to the fact that they had strong arguments about certain things. Maybe his son-in-law was there and saw one of their strong arguments. But he says that, when you're yedidim minoar shekamonu, when we're close friends like we are, these disagreements don't really affect the friendship. And, and that is absolutely correct and absolutely true. Rav Isser Zalman, in many ways, held a number of positions that Rav Kook held with regard to how the community should function in the future state. And we know that Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer was thrilled with the creation of the State of Israel. In this, he really diverges from the traditional Agudist perspective. And we know it's not just when he came to the, actually, I shouldn't say that, because when he, it's not just when he came to the land of Israel, but it continues there, and it's not just in the land of Israel. I have a document which has Brisker communications, I guess you could say. I think they're accurate. You could say, well, who says they're correct? But in any event, this comes from the heart of Brisk in Jerusalem, and they quote Rav Chaim Moshe Grozinski as saying the reason why he didn't want Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer to be on the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah is because you couldn't rely on Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. He'd say one thing one day, one thing another day. Take it for what it's worth. The fact remains, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer was never on the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah, and you would expect in the land of Israel for him to be very close to the Chazon Ish, not which he was as a friend, but you'd expect him to follow his perspective, perhaps, on ideological matters. Furthermore, the Brisker Rav, who he was very close with, the son of Reb Chaim, you'd expect perhaps him to follow his approach, but neither. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer did not go that way. On the contrary, he really remained identified with the official rabbinate. And that really follows what we saw already, that his Zionistic leanings when he was in the land of Israel that we spoke, when he was in Europe that we spoke about. On page 47, it reprints here a eulogy that Rav Reuven Katz gave on Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer after he passed away. It comes from Reuven Katz's book, Sha'ar Reuven, and he discusses how happy, Ma Rabba Ugdola Haita Simchato, how happy and thrilled Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer was that when he was worthy, Shezachal wrote with his own eyes, the establishment of Medinat Yisrael. Rav Reuven goes on to say it's true that there are many of the Orthodox who were worried about the irreligious and everything, and there was a reason to be worried, he says, but nevertheless, Rav Isser Zalman recognized how significant this was, that after 2,000 years, that Jews are actually in control of their own destiny. And this isn't something that's secret. This isn't some propaganda by the non-religious. This is something by the Zionists. This is something that the Haredi world, during Rav Isser Zalman's lifetime, had a difficult time coming to terms with, because they expected him to be more in the camp of the Chazon Ish and the Brisker Rav, and he wasn't. And yet, nevertheless, because of who he was and the great respect already had in Europe, and the great respect that the Brisker Rav and the Chazon Ish gave to him, even though he had a different perspective, he remains in the canon. And there's no sign anytime soon that he's going to be removed from the canon. And with the Haredi world, you never know. I mean, if you pay attention to Haredi writings, you already have begun to see the beginnings of a removal of Rav Pesach Frank from the canon, which is shocking when you think of it, who Rav Pesach Frank was. And this never would have happened in his lifetime, in subsequent years, the Haredi world, if they want to ensure conformity, they really have two approaches. One is the approach of censorship that I document, covering it up. And when that's too difficult, then you slowly begin to push people out of the community. And there have been censorship of Rav Pesach Frank's Haskamot and other things. And that has not happened at all with Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, even though he has views that are not in line. We'll get to it. Yes, Moshe Feig, could we see it the other way around with Rav Elyashiv? 100%. We saw it with Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach to a large extent, where then you try to kosher him for that community. It goes both ways. I now want to talk about an event which, in its day, was perhaps the most shocking event that ever happened in the Yishuv during the Great Dispute against Rav Kook. It was something whose repercussions were felt all the way in Europe. It was something whose repercussions were felt to the end of a certain person's life, as I'll explain. And even writing about it, and I mean, even speaking about it, it's shocking today. And that's what happened on Shushan Purim in 1932. Just a bit of background here before I explain what happened. You need to understand that the Agudas Yisrael in Europe. Those who read my Sfarim blog posts know that I said, not the last post, the post before, that there is yet to be a history of the Agudas Yisrael in which really deals with the situation of Agudas Yisrael and Rav Kook in the land of Israel, and that at the end of the day, Agudas Yisrael has to be called to account, and we're going to see soon, we're going to see Yehuda Kook has to say, for how Rav Kook was treated, and because it was. The stuff we're going to talk about was done under the auspices of Agudas Yisrael. Now you're going to say, how is that possible? The people in Europe, the leaders of Agudas Yisrael, Rav Chaim Moser Grudzinski and the rest of them, were the closest of friends to Rav Kook and his great admirers. But you had a very strange situation. And you can really blame, I think, to a large extent, the German Orthodox for setting this up. When the Agudas Yisrael decided to establish itself in the land of Israel, they had a choice. They could have allied themselves with the larger community, Rav Kook's camp and the Dayanim, and all those great rabbis. And that's the community that the typical Lithuanian and Polish Jews, when they came on Aliyah, that's the community that they joined. And this is what led to the Great Break, as we'll see in Aguda in the 40s. But that didn't happen. Because you had the German Orthodox, who really ran to a large extent the Aguda in the 1920s. Even when you brought in all the Lithuanians and the great rabbis there, the Aguda really ran it from a functional sense. They had this ideology of separatism that you had to completely separate from the irreligious. And therefore, they ensured that the Agudas Yisrael would ally itself with the opponents of Rav Kook and the opponents of the Vaad Lehumi, this small group called the Yedda Charedit, which still exists to this day, and was led by Rav Sonnenfeld, later Rav Dushinsky. So here's the whole the strange thing about this: you have a tiny group, it was a very small group of extremists and of separatists. Who refused to accept the chief rabbinate, refused to be part of the Dayanim, refused to accept the Vaad Lehumi, they really totally opposed to secular studies, everything. The Agudas Yisrael, which is a worldwide organization with offices in America, all over Europe, they ally themselves, and the Aguda in the land of Israel, the branch of the world Agudas Yisrael, is not all the great rabbis we've spoken about, Reuven Katz and Rav Isser Zalman and all the rest, and it is not the Chazon Ish even. It's this Yedda Charedit in Jerusalem. The irony is that the Yedda Charedit, other than agreeing on separatism, they have nothing in common with the German Orthodox or any of the others for that matter. They have in common with the Hungarians, but the Hungarians in Hungary were not a member of the Agudas Yisrael. because they thought it was too moderate. Jacob Katz, in his autobiography, he comes from the Frankfurt. He's come from Hungary, but he goes to Frankfurt, and he's a member of the Hirschian community. He talks about when he went to Eretz Yisrael and he went to get married. Since he was a member of the Aguda, who did the wedding? Rav Dushinsky, and he speaks about how strange this was. Here, they're a member of German Orthodox Torim Derech Eretz, and yet their rabbi in the land of Israel was a Hungarian, one who was totally opposed to secular studies. Culturally, you can't be any far removed from the German Orthodox than the Yehuda Haredit, but that was the Aguda office in the land of Israel. Now, with the Yehuda Haredit, the extremists, came a lot of fanatics. They've always had the fanatics. If you want to know the fanatics that you see today, the crazies, the one in Beit Shemesh, all that, these are all part of the same community. And the mainstream, that is the rabbinic leadership, has never been able to control these fanatics. The question is how much they've wanted to control them. Do they see them as valuable? They've even turned on themselves. If you follow the inner Haredi disputes, you have these crazies going after a Moshe Sternbach. But you've always had these literally madmen, psychopaths who've been involved, in the Yehuda Haredit on the margins. And it's the rabbis are often afraid of them because they'll turn on them. And so the incidents we're going to discuss now emanate from the Yehuda Haredit. So the question always is, what's the Yehuda Haredit going to do about it? What's the Aguda going to do about it? Because the Yehuda Haredit is a member of the Agudas Yisrael, and therefore what happens in Israel by them, now they had a newspaper called Kol Yisrael, I think it was. And they defame Rav Kook every week, and the Aguda in Poland and in Lithuania didn't know what to do about this because they were then identified with it, but they didn't know what else to do. So that's the background. Let me now tell you the story. And that's what I mean when I say that no one's ever written about, and Agudas Yisrael has never taken it, has never come to terms with this, has never taken account of this, has never done an alchait. Because at the end of the day, it was a branch of the Agudas Yisrael that engaged in an unbelievable Chilul Hashem going on for about 15 years and did nothing about it. These groups in Israel, and it's the same thing you see today, they can come out with statements about the gay parade, they can come out with statements about the irreligious, about the draft, they can come out with statements left and right about women at the wall, things that have nothing to do with their communities. But they will never come out about with statements against their own community. It doesn't. Not, these rabbis don't agree with the crazies in Beit Shemesh and anything, but they will never criticize their own communities in the because they're all it's incestuous. They're all. You had this is Shushan Purim in 1932. You had a group of members of the Tzeirei Agudas Yisrael. That is official members of the Agudas Yisrael youth organization. They met at a shul in a place called Batei Broida. Batei Broida was a courtyard. You can go online. It's by Nachlaot, I think it is. And there's an area there for a Masibas Purim, for a Purim celebration. And one of the things that happened at this Masiba, this party, was a play. They put on a play, and this play was advertised in their newspaper, actually, I shouldn't say the newspaper. No, they hung up signs. I believe they hung up signs. Let me tell you right now whether it was in the newspaper or signs about it. Let's see. Because someone who was involved with this. Oh, yeah, Itonia and Kol Yisrael. Okay, in their newspaper. Remember, this is the official Agudas Yisrael newspaper. The official Agudas Yisrael newspaper was engaged in character assassination every week. Now, some of you might think, what's the big deal? Yatei Ne'eman engages in character assassination every week. But Yatei Ne'eman is, it's not the official newspaper of the Agudas Yisrael. It is, I guess, the official newspaper of Degel HaTorah. And I have to say, they don't engage so much anymore. In the previous administration, before Rav Steinman came in and cleaned house, they engaged in character assassination literally on a weekly basis. Now it's much better. So there was an ad in the Kol Yisrael newspaper, the Aguda paper, an official Aguda paper, which announced that they were going to have this play. And what's the play going to be about? It's going to be about a Psak. This is the name of the play. Psak Din Leitzanuta de Avoda Zarah of Yisrael. It's, they're going to have a judgment, a court judgment, dealing with, making fun of Avoda Zarah and things related to that. Now, what happened in this play? In this play, and it wasn't announced in the newspaper exactly what took place at this play, but all the people knew what took place in the play because they were putting it on. Rav Kook was put on trial. This was the Purim spiel. Rav Kook was put on trial for his heresies and his Avodah Zarah, and at the end he was sentenced to death, and the ruling was carried out. Rav Kook was executed by the members of the Tzeirei Agudas Yisrael at the shul in the Bate Broida neighborhood. Now, the response to this was severe because this became known very quickly all over Jerusalem that members of the Agudas Yisrael had just put on a play in which Rav Kook was executed as someone deserving of the death penalty. Not exactly something that's, yeah, we understand that in a Purim play, sometimes you can go online, YouTube, and you could see a Purim play from the 80s in which there's one of the guys, one of the Bachrim, makes believe he's Rav Shach. And has his accent and everything. There's a long tradition, even though Rav Avad Yosef has a tshuva in which he says it's forbidden to do this. But he's not an Ashkenazi. He doesn't know that there's a long tradition. Maybe some of you guys from Lakewood and elsewhere could tell me if it still goes on. Rav Gorin was asked about this in his recently published response, and he said that this is a long tradition. In other words, in yeshivas, they've been making lighthearted humor jokes about the Rosh Yeshiva for well over 100 years, 150 years. So if you tell me today that it's off limits, that means the Masorah has been broken, because that's what people did. And as I said, you can go online and you can see someone imitating Rav Shach with his accent and the way he speaks. And it's but to put Rav Kook on trial and to execute him. And as I said, the response was severe, and people saw it as an indictment of Agudas Yisrael, because this was an official Agudas Yisrael organization which did this, and the assumption of many was that the young people here, these were teenagers, maybe early 20s, that they were just carrying on the views of their parents. And many of their parents were known as unbelievable extremists. So you had some of these people, parents, who had been attacking Rav Kook. Of course, when they needed Rav Kook for something, they'd come to him, and Rav Kook would always give it to them. But you had people put in jail, prior to this for the way, for the defamation of Rav Kook. And what the reason why the response also was so severe is what happened here with the trial and execution of Rav Kook could be seen as the natural culmination of what the leaders of Aguda had been doing for really the last 12 years. So you're going to say, well, the kids will be kids and they'll go overboard. They were just carrying it, if the parents were saying Rav Kook is a heretic and Rav Kook is saying heretical things and all that, then the next step is the children actually, carrying it out. Well, if he's a heretic, he deserves to be executed. The Aguda leaders in Germany and Poland were furious. I mean, there is correspondence which between you, it's hard to get into the Aguda archives. I've never gotten into that, but there have been people who've gotten into it. Menachem Friedman, in his book, he was given permission. He wrote a book on Haredi society in the early years. I keep, trying to get in, but so far unsuccessful. They closed the archives, but there was a time when they were allowed in. And what one of the things that was revealed is that the leaders of the Aguda in Germany and in Lithuania and Poland would send letters to the Aguda in Jerusalem saying, "What's going on here? What's with this craziness? What's with your newspaper attacking, Rav Kook and other rabbis?" And they really didn't know. But all this was private, except for one case that I recall in the German Orthodox newspaper, the Israelite. I think it was after this when they came out and defended Rav Kook and attacked what happened. But for the most part, this was all behind the scenes, where the Aguda leaders in Europe were trying to control, the branch in Jerusalem, but they couldn't control the branch. And the price, what was the option? The option would be just to cut them off, but that they couldn't do. So they were stuck with them. The Kollel Poland Warsaw. In Jerusalem, you had you had kollels, not kollels that we think of, but organizations that went back already to the 19th century, which were supported by groups of Jews in Europe. So it was called Kollel Poland Warsaw. So it was the Orthodox the community which arose from Poland, and they were identified with Agudas Yisrael in Poland. They publicly identified with Rav Kook and asked Rav Kook to come speak to them. Again, this was a way of protesting what happened. 2 months later, after this, Rav Eliyahu Klatskin dies. Here is Rav Eliyahu Klatskin. Eliyahu Klatskin was a Rav of Lublin, an unbelievable Gaon, great, great Torah scholar, who also knew all sorts of secular things, and he had a photographic memory. His son was Yaakov Klatskin. Yaakov Klatskin is a leading Zionist and a leading heretic. When I say a leading heretic, I'm not talking about Ben Gurion or anything like that. Yaakov Klatskin had a whole theory. I mean, he was a theoretician of secular Zionism. Yaakov Klatskin, who begins as a Talmud Chacham and even writes Chiddushei Torah, becomes a complete denier, atheist. I believe an atheist. And a theoretician of secular Zionism, he intermarries, and that's. But nevertheless, he and his father, Eliyahu Klatskin, had a good relationship to the end. And in the book edited by Rabbi Leo Young, I think Guardians of Our People or something like that, there's an article by Yaakov Klatskin about his father in it. But I went through the Yaakov Klatskin archive in Jerusalem, and there's lots of letters between father and son. So Eliyahu Klatskin comes to Jerusalem, and Eliyahu Klatskin in Europe was never seen as an extremist. But when he comes to Israel, he identifies with the Eda Haredit, which is very unusual because he's like the only rabbi I know who wasn't really Hungarian. Well, take that back. There's another one, right, Bengus. But very unusual to identify with the Eda Haredit. He wasn't an opponent of Rav Kook, but he identified with the Eda Haredit. The successor of Rav Dushinsky, Rizal Gluvain Bengis, was a very close friend of Rav Kook. So not all the Eda Haredi people were personal enemies of Rav Kook, but you had many who were. He dies, and Rav Kook was set to deliver a hesped. The family of Rav Klatskin knew that they were close, Rav Kook was close with him, but the same crazies who attacked Rav Kook, from the Tzeirei Agudas Yisrael and the rest of the crazies. Rav Klatskin's coffin was intended to be brought into the courtyard of the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, where Rav Kook was supposed to give a hesped. They prevented it from coming into the courtyard so that Rav Kook would not be able to give the hesped. Now, after the trial of Rav Kook, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer and Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein publicized the following letter, which they sent to Rav Kook. And at least in theory, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer is a member of the Aguda, or was a member of the Aguda. It says this, you can see this letter in the letters to Rav Kook, Igrot L'Riyah, and also it appears in many other places. Yedidenu, Haga'on, Hagadol, Mofet Hador, our friend, the great Gaon, wonder of the generation, Rav Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, Rav Rashi L'Artzeinu HaKdosha. See, when you refer to Rav Kook as the Rav Rashi, the chief rabbi, or Mara D'Asra, you are showing your attachment to him and your recognition of him. All the people in the Yedah Haredit, they referred to Rav Zonnenfeld, the head of the Eda Haredit, as the Rav Rashi or the Mara D'Asra. So, but that's what they refer to Rav Kook. And they say, we join together with your great pain that, these Tse'irim, went out against you, Bechiruf, the Giduf, attacking you, cursing you, Bedvarim, Asher, which no one can believe. And, the ears cannot hear this stuff. And they say, in our opinion, you shouldn't pay any attention to this, because they didn't they were not pogea, they did not damage your honor, because the disgrace is upon them. And all we can do is protest the hefkerut of Isser Bizaron HaTorah, protest the fact that the prohibition of disgracing the Torah has reached such proportions, and chilul kvod haCharedim, and destroying the honor of the Orthodox, and our only nechama, our only comfort, is that this was done by young people who are not responsible for their actions. So that's the letter they wrote in response to this. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer also, who used to daven at that shul in Batei Broida, when the people in that shul refused to ban the members who put on this trial, that is, Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer said that they have to forbid those people, those young people, from entering the shul anymore. Ban them because of what they did. They used the shul to do the most disgraceful act imaginable. Maybe the most disgraceful act in the 20th century ever done to a great Torah sage, but the leaders of the shul refused to ban them. You know, as far as they were concerned, not such a terrible thing, and therefore Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer leaves that shul and refuses to daven there and never comes there again. Now, among the people, and I'm sorry about my face, but don't look at the face, it keeps freezing. Among the people involved, one of the members who was part of this group that put Rav Kook on trial and executed him was this man. I don't know if any of your people recognizes this man. This is Rav Menachem Porush. Rav Menachem Porush, who dies, born in 1916, so in 1932 he's only 16 years old. He dies in 2010. He was a member of Knesset for the Agudas Yisrael for many years. I'll get it in here. Let me pull it up for you here. How many years he was a member of Knesset for. But he used to have a column in the Jewish press. I don't know if people used to read the Jewish press. He used to have a column. He was the most, he was a member of Knesset for Agudas Yisrael from 1959 between 1959 and 1975, and then again from 77 to 94. So maybe the Agudas Yisrael's longest member of Knesset. And he was one of the people who was involved with this. If you look, I was curious just last week when I was preparing this class, I wanted to know, do people know about this? Or is this something that I know and the average person doesn't know? So what do you do today? You go to Hebrew Wikipedia. And lo and behold, it mentions this. It says that he learned in Yeshiva Seitz Chaim in 1932 when he was 16. He was thrown out of the Yeshiva Seitz Chaim by order of the Beis Din of the Chief Rabbinate. That would be Ritzi Pesach Frank's Beis Din. They ordered the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva to throw him out. You wouldn't need them to throw. I don't think you would need Ritzi Pesach Frank. I think what happened was that obviously Rav Zalman wanted to throw them out also, but they wanted a psak from the Beis Din. You couldn't go to the Eda Charedit Beis Din because they don't care or they're not interested. They never do anything against these people. So he was thrown out. Why? Now this, I didn't even know this. I knew that he was involved in the trial, but Wikipedia says because he was the one who played the part of Rav Kook in the trial. So he wasn't just someone who participated. He played Rav Kook. But then I found, Wikipedia has a link, the Hebrew Wikipedia, to an interview Menachem Porush gave about this, which, by the way, this incident followed him his entire life. And, Ritzvi Yehuda Kook, to the end of Ritzvi Yehuda Kook's life, his attitude was Menachem Porush is in Cherem. You can't have anything to do with him. He's a mukhram, and Agudas Yisrael refuses to, because he never apologized or anything. That's what Ritzvi Yehuda said. And I'll read you more of what Ritzvi Yehuda said. But he gave this interview towards the end of his life to Chagai Segal, and the title of the interview is, well, no, he talked about lots of things, and the section of this interview is Lo Yariti B'Rav Kook. I didn't shoot Rav Kook. What I always heard was that he was involved in actually shooting Rav Kook, because after the trial, they didn't execute Rav Kook in accordance with Jewish law, which itself is strange. Because if Rav Kook is going to be executed, then you have to give him skila or hered, take a sword out or something like that. We don't have a penalty of executing but with a gun, unless you say these are extrajudicial measures, in which case the Beis Din can do whatever they want. So the title of this, and you can actually find the link on the Hebrew Wikipedia, the title of this section is "I Did Not Fire on Rav Kook," because, like I said, that was the story, that it was Menachem Porush who actually took the gun and killed Rav Kook. He says as follows. I'm reading from the interview. There's another parsha which has his whole life has rodefet et Porush, which chases after Porush. Among the religious Zionists, they accuse him that in his youth, he degraded Rav Kook in a terrible way. And it says, for all the elders of Yeshivas Merkaz HaRav, there's a different version of what happened there. But everyone knows that Porush did a terrible thing. And this has not, this was not forgotten. And then when he was, even when he joined after Oslo, the right wing to try to prevent, withdrawal, people still remembered. That is, to the end of his life, in the circles of Rav Kook and Merkaz HaRav, the man you're looking at was always regarded as a Rasha, as an evil person, for what he did. So then Chagai Segal says, I raised this matter with hesitation. I didn't want to hargiz, to excite, annoy an elderly man. But it turns out that Porush very much wanted to speak about this. He wanted to set matters straight in order to clear his name. And it says that in his book, he deals in detail with this matter. Now, I don't know, because I look, you're talking about a book he hasn't yet published. The interview, he was writing an autobiography. He did publish an autobiography of a number of volumes of his life. And I looked in it and I did not see, I could not find the section where he speaks about it. And what does he do? Porush, Me'id al atzmo shamayim v'aretz. Porush claims that the version of the story that he is going to tell with the interviewer right now is the correct one, and the others are not correct. So I'm going to tell you the story now in which he defends himself. It's hard to know whether Porush is telling the truth because, on the one hand, he says this is what happened, so you don't want to, you want to believe him. On the other hand, if it's not what happened, and if he really was, right there, front and center, he still would tell this story if he needed to clear his name. So, without any other evidence, without anyone else, and it's a little hard to imagine that the stories, which all put him as front and center, which he was proud of at the time, apparently, the other people were certainly proud that it would have developed. But take it for what it's worth. I'm going to give you Porush's version. Now, Porush knew that as a politician, sometimes you can lie to in the name of peace. So maybe he was lying, maybe he wasn't. Let me just tell you what Porush claimed happened. First of all, he explains that his family was split when it came to Rav Kook. One of his relatives, he tells us, named Akiva Porush, was the one who carried on, who was the front and center, the leader of the polemics, the attacks on Rav Kook. And he pub and Porush says that this cousin of his, I guess her uncle, Akiva Porush, published against him all the terrible Pashkevilut. I mean, the things they said about Rav Kook. There's 5 volumes, of Pashkevilut that were published. This guy in Israel, he was great. Going back to the 1920s, the people in those days, Pashkevilut was much more important than today. People would put these things on the walls in Mea Shearim and Geula, and most people don't take it seriously. You look at it, you ignore it. But you know what they say, that the junk today, the ephemera today, is tomorrow's history. The Harvard University Library, every time there's an election in Israel, they send someone to Israel. And they go to all the political rallies and they collect the little ephemera. That's what they call them, ephemera, the election brochures and things like that. Because years from now, this stuff is not going to be available, except, but Harvard keeps this because it's important and it won't be around anywhere else. There was a guy who tore off the wall every time one of these new Pashkevillim came up. He kept a copy, or he got a copy given to him, and he had a huge archive in Mea Shearim of all of them. And at the end of his life, I think they sold them to Hebrew University, and then they put them together in five volumes. I cited them in my book, my latest book. All you have is five volumes of the Pashkevillim with descriptions of them. These are very important historical documents because it shows the battles, especially in the Orthodox world, in Jerusalem in the 1920s, before the pro-Rav Kook, the anti-Rav Kook. And without this man saving these Pashkevillim, which were the equivalent of, that was the mass media in those days, we would be lacking a lot. So this guy, Akiva Porush, was responsible for some of the worst of the attacks on Rav Kook. And these people, these crazies, they didn't just attack Rav Kook. When the Ger Rebbe came and he met with Rav Kook, they attacked the Ger Rebbe, they attacked the Lubavitch Rebbe. Then there was another Karov Mishpacha named Mendel Porush, and he was one of the great admirers of Rav Kook. And you can go on Otzer HaChachma, if you have it, and you can see Mendel Porush's his memoir from Jerusalem, and he has so much important information as well. So Porush, Menachem Porush, says that my family was split. He goes on and says that this Mendel Porush once threatened to lay down on the tracks, the train tracks, if Rav Kook did not accept the position of chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael. Then it goes on that young Menachem Porush acknowledges that he was in the camp of Akiva Porush, that is the anti-Rav Kook camp. And then he tells the story. One of the days in Chodesh Adar, he just says one of the days of Chodesh Adar, but it was Shushan Purim. In one of the days of Chodesh Adar, he saw, this would be before that, he saw in the newspaper, Kol Yisrael, that's the Aguda paper, an announcement, that is, that the entire Tzibur should come to the Beit Knesset in Batei Broida because they're going to have a Purim Suda called Leitzanusa de Avodah Zarah, mocking Avodah Zarah. And Porush claims that he had no idea what was actually going to happen at this party. He was 16 years old. He dressed himself up in his best costume, which was a costume of a magid, someone, a rabbinic figure, complete with a long beard. And he went to the mesiba to see what's going on, dressed up. And then he says as follows. Who, this is a quote, who could have anticipated that this costume of mine would lead to such a development that I was sherodefetoti kol yamai, that I'm, persecuted about this my entire life. When I came to the synagogue, right at the moment I came to the synagogue, they were doing the mishpat against Rav Kook. The three judges, in quotation marks, were sitting there judging Rav Kook. And one of them was my relative, Rav Shlomo Zalman Porush. When they saw me, that is, when all the people saw me in my costume, they decided that I was fitting to be the character of Rav Kook. And then they gave the decision right then and there that that I have to be killed. And that's exactly what they did. They took out a toy gun and they fired at me, said, "You are dead. You are sentenced to death. Pow, you're dead." I, this is Porush saying, I didn't even know what's going on. He says, "I feel oivanti makara. I don't know what's happening." Oh, he claims he walks in. They declare punishment is death. They pick up a gun and they shoot it at me, and I don't know what they're talking about. And he says, and there was a round, because why didn't I understand? Because surrounding me there was a whole commotion. Later, when I understood that I had just been executed as Rav Kook, Nivhalti Ma'od, I was quite shocked. Then he says, this Purim spiel created great, Hedim Gedolim, had great impact and a great storm. The chief rabbinate's Beit Din gathered in an emergency session and commanded that Rav Shlomo Zalman Porush, who at that time was the accountant, he did the books for Yeshivas Eitz Chaim, he has to be thrown out of the yeshiva. And they also ruled that I have to be thrown out of the yeshiva. He says, Lo ho yu'u, kohit not salut. Uvakashot Hasicha. He says, all my apologies and requests, for forgiveness did not help. I wasn't allowed back in the yeshiva. Leyamim, as time went on, as this story passed from pet to ozen, it was distorted, and it became that I was the one that shot Rav Kook. Uvachein, and therefore, ani me'id atzmi, I publicly declare, Shemeolam lo pagati ba'af tamid chacham, I've never, come out, I've never damaged, pagati, I don't know the word, hit, attacked, I guess, a tamid chacham, v'adai lo b'gdol Yisrael me'kol chuk shehu, and certainly not a gadol b'Yisrael in any circle. So here we have Menachem Parush claiming it all was a misunderstanding. I was dressed up like this elderly rabbi. I walk in right at the end of the Masiba. Lo and behold, they decide I look like I could be the figure of Rav Kook, and they decide to execute me by saying the sentence is death. Take out the gun and say, now we will shoot you. That's Parush's claim. I don't know. Well, what can you say? None of us were there. It's hard to believe that only at the end of his life he decides to give an interview, and he reveals that, and that all the stories, even if he didn't, shoot the gun, to say, to assume that he knew nothing, that he had no idea. Remember, it was his family that was running this masiba, all his friends. It was his community. The idea that he didn't know what was happening, that everyone else knew what was happening, that it was something to judge Rav Kook. The idea that he didn't know till he got there. It strains imagination, but that's what he claims. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook mentions this event in his letter to Ravitcher Meir Levin. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook was invited to come to the Agudas Yisrael convention. I said that we'd end today with Ravitcher Zalman. I see that I have two more pages of material to do, so we're not going to end. But let me just, we should end now, because what I want to talk about is how this incident impacted Agudas Yisrael in the land of Israel with Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook and Moshe Blau, and then discuss the Hespedim of Rav Rishu Zalman and Meltzer on Rav Kook. And then I just want to briefly tell you about Rav Rishu Zalman Meltzer and the Dateline. And repeat one or two more stories, and I'll end with a very interesting or strange chidush of Rav Zal Meltzer and the Yevon HaAzel. But I believe that 20, 30 minutes by next class will be done with Rav Zalman, and we'll be able to move on to another member of Rav Kook's camp. It's really hard to call him a member of Rav Kook's camp, because when you deal with Rav Charlap, you're dealing with something which almost has never happened in the Lithuanian world. It's happened in the Hasidic world. But someone who was so, I don't even know if we have an English word for this, to be mevatel oneself. Rav Charlap, when it comes to Rav Kook, is totally, to say he's a student is not even enough. He is a recreation, really, of Rav Kook. His whole personality becomes Rav Kook, and the relationship that these two had is closer, in not just in an intellectual sense, in an emotional sense, than any other gedolim in the 20th century. And I think maybe that's going to explain a negative view that Rav Kook has about something Rav Charlap. No, sorry, that Rav Weinberg has about something Rav Charlap wrote. And Rav Charlap, as we'll see, is someone who comes from the old yeshiva. Of someone who comes, whose friends were these crazies, and then Rav Charlap leaves them and joins with Rav Kook. So we will definitely start Rav Charlap, but we'll only start with him. But it's already 10 o'clock, so let me deal with the questions and comments. But everyone should remember that this incident of the trial of Rav Kook was just the most extreme of the Aguda-inspired incidents against Rav Kook in the 1930s, 20s, and 1930s, and then it leads by the 1940s with the Aliyah of the Polish Jews, and who are leaving Poland of the 1930s. Sorry, by the end of the 1930s, when you had many Polish Jews who came on Aliyah, the mindset of the Agudistan from Poland and Germany, from Poland and Lithuania, and also Germany, They had nothing to do with these fanatics and the crazies, and even with the mainstream Haredi people. Culturally, they were so different that they refused to be any part of it. And by the late 1940s, even before the state is declared, when it's clear that Agudas Yisrael is going to join the state of Israel, then you have a break and the two separate. But they, through the 1940s, officially, the Eda Haredit was the. I'll have to get the exact date of when the break exactly was. So let me look at the questions and comments. And as I said, next week we'll see how Reb Tzvi Yehuda, he would not forget and he would not forgive. And he's the only one who really pushed this issue. Moshe says, I haven't seen one in Lakewood. I've seen many in Philadelphia. I forgot what I asked. I asked if you've seen, so remind me what it was that I remember I asked you if people have seen, let's see, I can't remember. Let's see. I had asked something if. If they, oh yeah, okay. I asked if you know this thing where you lightly mock the Rosh Yeshiva, and Moshe is saying that he haven't seen in Lakewood, but he's seen many in Philadelphia. As Rav Gorin wrote, you know, someone wrote to him that you know it's disrespectful. Shouldn't we stop it? That's exactly what Rav Yosef says. Rav Gorin says that this is the Masorah, this is the tradition. He comes from Rav Gorin comes from the Chevron Yeshiva. Moshe from Lakewood says his father was a Talmud of the Chasam Sofer, so he probably identified with the Hungarians. You're saying that Rav Klatskin? Maybe that's what you're saying. So Moshe from Lakewood says, what is the work called? The work of Menachem Porush, I forget. Email me, I'll give it to you. I don't want to. I could go online as I'm speaking to you, let's say to the Harvard catalog and quickly get it, but I don't want to leave us and it'll take me a minute to find it. But oh, you have to go to the Harvard Library catalog and put in Menachem Porush. Actually, no, I have, hold on, I'll be able to get it right now, I think, because I was, no, I don't have it, but it's his memoir. Email me, I'll find it for you in a second. The other thing I was mentioning, unless you're talking about the newspaper report, the interview, that you can get the link on the Hebrew Wikipedia. Moshe says Reb Baruch Ber. I don't know what he mean, what you're referring to, Reb Baruch Ber, if you're talking about more extreme elements. Reb Baruch Ber was not at the Aguda convention. Reb Baruch Ber has letter, at least one or two letters to Rav Kook that I know of. Reb Baruch Ber was a follower of the more extreme approach, but it never affected him personally. I mean, he's the one that defended Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. So I'm not sure what you mean by Reb Baruch Ber. Yisrael asks, were the non-religious elements in the general communities Eastern Europe as anti-religious and as dominant as those in Frankfurt? And the answer is yes. For many of them, yes. For many of them, no. Frankfurt, you had reform, which is, of course, anti-religious. You did not have reform in Eastern Europe. What you had were Jews who were not observant, let's say Zionist type, but still would go to shul on Shabbos. And if they didn't go to shul on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, they still had a soft sense for religion. On the other hand, you also had socialists who were anti-religious, and unlike the reformers in Frankfurt, who wanted to open up a synagogue, a reform synagogue, and practice as Jews, just practice in a different way, the socialist Jews didn't want to practice Judaism at all. They wanted nothing to do with Judaism. I don't know what's worse: Jews who want to practice Judaism but want to distort Judaism. Or Jews who don't want to distort Judaism, they want nothing to do with Judaism. And that's a debate between rabbis, I think, in America and Israel. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, in one of his essays, says that It's obvious. He sees it as obvious. I think that American Jews see it as obvious that if you have a choice between a secular Jew and a reformer conservative Jew, you prefer the reformer conservative Jew. Because at least they're getting some Jewish identity. At least they're getting something, some connection. Maybe it'll stop them from intermarrying. A secular Jew has nothing. They'll just intermarry. In Israel, it might be different. In Israel, you might prefer the secular Jew because basically they're not going to intermarry, and they, at least they don't have a distorted Judaism, so you could, an empty, if they have nothing, you can fill it with real Judaism. But I met once with Rav Chaim Sarna, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Chevron Yeshiva. And whatever, we were talking, I went to get letters from Rabbi Weinberg, and I don't know how the conversation led to this, but he, not, I'm not sure. Oh, yeah, we started speaking about Rav Kook. And it led to why his, I asked him why his father opposed the approach of Rav Kook. So we led to the, we led to a discussion about the non-religious. And I said to him, and he made a comment about the Reform and the non-Orthodox Jews. And I said to him that in America, we all assume that it's better to be a Reform or conservative Jew than to be a secular Jew. I mean, the typical Israeli secularist who comes to America just disappears. They have no, they live like goyim. They're not involved in the larger community, federation, anything like that. Every Orthodox community has Jews who come from the conservative world. A good conservative Jew is the best thing for Orthodoxy because it creates many Baalei Tshuva. But Rav Chaim Sarna was shocked that I said this. He couldn't imagine that. He felt just the opposite. I mean, he was adamant that no, a secular Jew is much better because a secular Jew has nothing. And the reforming conservative Jew, it's distorted Judaism. It could be that you know, he's reflecting his sentiment that in Israel, and maybe I don't live in Israel, maybe in Israel, from the standpoint of the Orthodox, it's better to have a secular than to have a conservative, although I think you can make the case that at least a conservative Jew does mitzvot, you know, more mitzvot than a. But Rav Chaim Sarna, though, but I'm not going to speak about Israel because I don't live there, but Chaim Sarna wasn't just speaking about Israel, he was making a general statement about America, and he did not believe me when I said to him that in America, everyone assumes, when I say everyone, I mean even the rabbis, the Haredi rabbis, that you'd rather have a conservative Jew who has some connection than nothing. So you had, so in answer to your question, Yisrael, you had plenty of anti-religious, and all the rabbanim had to deal with these anti-religious people as well. That was life. The Netziv says, the Netziv has a famous letter, responsa, in which he explains why in Lithuania they oppose these separate communities in Hungary and Frankfurt. He's referring in particular, they were trying to create such a group in Galicia. And he says that we fight among ourselves. But when we face the, and he's talking about the irreligious, he says, we fight among ourselves. But when we face the non-Jews, we face as one community. And Agudas Yisrael of America, which is supposed to come out of, you know, Frankfurt and that whole philosophy, they have adopted the Netziv's approach. They don't act as Agudas Yisrael did in Europe. When they go to Washington, they go together with the Conference of Presidents, and they go with all the different Jewish organizations, and they meet with the president, and they do all these things. They don't allow their people, the masses, to have anything to do with the irreligious. Therefore, they refuse to sponsor, to become a joint sponsor. Remember the big rally in Washington, D.C. about 10 years ago against terrorism? Even though many Agudist people came, Agudas Yisrael as a whole refused to sponsor it, even though this was only about a mass rally in opposition to terrorism, because they can't ever sponsor anything as a group, even in opposition to anti-Semitism, even to save Jewish lives. They will never co-sponsor something with the non-Orthodox as a matter of principle. Doesn't matter for what reason. However, it's a bit hypocritical because it's not really a matter of fear. It's not a matter of principle they do this. It's only a matter of tactics. They don't want their people to be involved and to hear speeches by people who maybe they don't approve of. But the leadership of Aguda is involved and with the non-religious all the time, and they do coordinate activities. You know, when it comes to the masses, they continue the separatist approach, but at the top, the leadership, they have the Lithuanian Polish approach. Yisrael says, who decides who gets in the Moetzis? It's like the College of Cardinals. You know, the Pope decides. No, it's they decide themselves. They choose. Rav Shach had a big problem with this. That's why eventually he would leave it, because you influential Rosh Yeshiva come in, but also Hasidic Rebbes. Hasidic Rebbes, who are in tune with the Aguda approach, if they have a large a following, they'll be let in. But for a Lithuanian, this is hard to stomach because although they might have a lot of influence, they don't have Das Torah necessarily. They don't have to be Torah sages. So here you're going to discuss what's important for the Jewish people. What's important for the Agudas Yisrael? From the Lithuanian perspective, you need Torah scholars there. If you're going to have a Hasidic Rebbe who's not a Torah scholar, the fact that he has a large following, that's great. But he should be following what the great Torah scholars say. If you have enough philosophy that Torah scholars have to determine policy, then how can you have a Hasidic Rebbe involved? But the Aguda has always had the Hasidic Rebbes as well. And today, not just today, for the last 50 years, the Moetzes Gedolei Torah it hasn't even met. They've gone to the model, what I call, the papal model, where there seems to be a strong inclination, not just in Christians, among Jews as well, that you want leadership by one. And it's a lot easier when you have leadership by one than a group. So there is no Moetzes anymore. In America, they might have it, but in Israel, it hasn't met, and it's meaningless because it's become a lot easier to go to the one great figure. So you go to Rav Steinman, or you go to Rav Elyashiv, or you go to Rav Shach, or you go to the Stipler, or you go to the Chazon Ish, or something. The idea that you would have the Moetzes and in the book on Agudas Yisrael, written by the man, I forget his name now, that's one of the major themes of the book, that the whole philosophy of the Moetzes Gedolei Torah was never able to work because dominant personalities always were able to emerge on top, even in America. I mean, in theory, there's a Moetzes, but does it do anything? Or is Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, or if Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky, is Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky first among equals, or Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky the dominant figure? So, if when the Moetzes meets, if Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky expresses his opinion, is it possible that you could actually have a majority that get together and disagree with Shmuel, and that carries the day, or will they just rubber stamp of Shmuel Kamenetsky's opinion? So the Moetzes Gedolei Torah is not really significant. Reb Baruch Ber was mevatel himself at Rochav. Yes, you are correct. Thank you for pointing out, Moshe. Reb Baruch Ber was so mevatel himself to Reb Chaim. Reb Baruch Ber, when Reb Baruch Ber was Rosh Yeshiva in his 40s, he would sit. I know this is crazy, and this is reported in Kamenetsky's book. It would be hard for us to grasp this. It sounds crazy, but Reb Chaim would, he would come to Reb Chaim, Reb Chaim would come to town, he would sit on his lap the same way he did 25 years earlier. At least that's what's reported. Reb Baruch Ber was completely mevatel himself. You are correct, and thank you. Did the anti-religious in Eretz Yisrael try to prevent the religious from practicing as they did in Frankfurt? Never. The anti-religious never tried to prevent the religious from practicing. What they did try to do is try to take young people who were religious, youngsters, and turn them irreligious. They did this with the Yemenites. They did this with the kids who came through Tehran from Europe. The irreligious definitely wanted to influence the younger people to become irreligious, but there never was any efforts by the irreligious to try to, let's say, ensure that the mikvahs were closed down as they did in Frankfurt, or that there wouldn't be funding for the religious. That they never really did. They couldn't. They would have liked to, but they knew they couldn't get away with that. And why did they need to? They figured, let's get the younger generation. The older generation would die out. From the standpoint of the secular Zionists, all you need to do is reach the younger generation. And they were very successful. They turned many of the younger generation irreligious. Children of Gedolei Yisrael became irreligious. And that's where they put their efforts, the younger generation. Okay, everyone, thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you all next week, where we will pick up with, we'll finish up with Rav Zalman, and we'll begin with Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap. Good night, everyone.